You ready?
This is the Mike Salk Show, serviced by Jaffco Plumbing and Sewer.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Are you ready?
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Are you ready for a good game?
All right, let's go. Mike Salk Show, 710 ESPN Seattle, 710sports.com as well. How you guys doing today? Justin, how you doing in there?
I'm just trying to read something.
Okay.
So I was a little distracted. Sorry about that. I'm good.
We're starting the show.
I thought you were asking me that because I looked like I was lost or something, which I was for a minute.
No, I was just saying, what's up, man?
Good morning.
We didn't really
get
to talk much this morning, so what's up?
I'm good.
All right.
How are you?
I'm great.
How are you doing? You were a little stressed out earlier because of your diet, but you seem to be in good spirits 30 seconds later.
I hate dieting.
I think I'm doing better than you because I'm eating.
Well, yeah, no kidding. There's no reason to
you
rub it in.
You asked how I was doing, so I'm just saying.
Thought you'd rub it in, make me feel worse about the fact
I couldn't do it, so I'm giving you props.
All right, well, here I am trying to remove a couple of months of gluttony with my green smoothie diet. It worked for me in August and September, lost like 20-something pounds, and so I'm going to try to do it again because I've probably gained, I don't know, 15 of them back. So,
Really?
Sure, dude. I won't weigh myself yet. There are times where I feel comfortable weighing myself and other times where I'm like, just don't do it. It's either it's not going to be as bad as you think and then you won't keep dieting, or it's going to be worse than you think and it's going to feel so overwhelming that you won't do it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I feel.
You're a runner, right?
Well, I was.
Okay.
Yeah, until this show started. I have not been running one time since we started doing this.
Well, that's
show.
Not true because you had a porta potty incident on one
I
of
guess
those
that
weekends.
Was, that's, so, yeah. That's literally the last time I've been running was that time. That was what, September? Yeah. So it's been a while. Those are things I used to do before we started doing the show. My life ended. And now I do the show and I work with you guys. We get some Seahawks defensive coordinator conversation to have today. Some names are emerging, much like the offensive coordinator side of it. A year ago, you know, the first name doesn't have to be the only name, right? So I'll admit to some of this. Like you get caught, like you see Ed Donatell and you're like, yeah, I've heard that name before. He's 65 years old or whatever. I don't know. Like, is this something that's going to really excite me? And then Clint Hurt's name is on there. And I know Clint Hurt's supposed to be a wonderful guy and incredibly motivating and smart and all of that. But you're like, well, he's kind of been here. And if, like, he had a good plan for Jamal Adams, don't you think he would have mentioned it to somebody by now? Like, so some of those moments, you're just like, I don't know. And then you got to remember, like, just because they're the first two names that come out doesn't mean that they're the only ones. And so maybe we'll hear more. Gus Bradley's name is certainly going to be out there as a possibility. I admit to liking that one. Later last night, we heard Sean Desai's name, and he's a very interesting background as being a philosophy major and a PhD in teaching. He was a professor. So some of that communication that sounded like it was an issue, my God. Go hire a PhD in education, and maybe that's kind of what you get out of it. So, I think some of the fear that Pete was only going to look within his own orbit, well, seeing some of the names that have emerged, as much as Pete does know Donatell, but they run different systems, and we'll learn a little bit more about him today. Sean Desai, obviously from a completely different system, coming from Chicago, Philadelphia, used to coach at Temple. So, you know, I liked some of the variety in where they're looking. It's not just, hey, this is what I want, and this is what I want to go get. This feels more close to the whole compete every day philosophy that's supposed to be at the crux of this whole thing. Good. Go compete by finding all of the different options that might be out there and all the different types of people that you might be able to find. I love this from Mark Schlereth, who was on yesterday with Bob and Dave in the afternoon, because I think I agree with this.
There's always guys in your building that you really like and all that. I just think that coaching perspective, from a player coaching perspective, That freshness, that ability to disagree and not be disrespectful, but discerning opinions and finding a way to mesh that stuff together, I think is vitally important in coaching in general.
Well, and I think especially important when you've fired somebody. Like, it's one thing when someone moves on because they've gotten the next opportunity, right? When Gus Bradley moved on because the next opportunity was there for him and you promoted Dan Quinn, like, yeah, that makes sense.
Totally.
Right. Dan Quinn gets a head coaching job somewhere else. And you're like, promote from within with Chris Richard. Let's go. Richard ends up not really working out. And they went technically outside with Ken Norton Jr. But at the time, it felt like the defense was still kind of like you had the right players, you just needed the right message. Okay, but now you're in a different spot. This was a fire, although nobody says fired anymore. Now it's relieved of duties, like we're in the military or something. Like I've relieved the colonel of his command.
Put out the pasture.
Right. So they've relieved Ken Norton Jr. of his duties.
So that's got to mean there's a different vibe in the building, too, because somebody was really... It wasn't nobody got promoted, nobody got stolen away, somebody was fired.
That's right. And that kind of happened with Chris Richard also, but it just felt like a kind of a different spot that the Seahawks were in at the time with kind of different personnel. And now it feels like, hey, someone's got to go get the most out of these guys. Someone's got to do something a little bit different than has been done the last few years. So when you're kind of viewing the names, I don't know too many of these. I can't tell you that much about Ed Donatell and personally. We'll hear a little bit from him or about him from Tyler Palumbus, who's in Denver. And he'll talk to us at 8 o'clock this morning. Love Tyler, former Seahawk, played offensive line here. I can't tell you if it's the right thing to do to hire Ed Donatell. I don't know about his X's and O's scheme, or I know he's more of a 3-4 guy, and so that's a little intriguing to me. Somebody who has some different points of view and has been, he was with Harbaugh, he was just with Vic Fangio, he's been with some different people, and I think that's always interesting to hire. But at the end of the day, I don't know who each of these guys are. I only know what the inclusion in the process means for the Seahawks, and so I like that it's not all just one type of guy. I like that they're looking in a few directions at once. So, kind of where we're at with the defense.
It's like a mechanic special when you see that when you're shopping for a car, and it's like, yeah, it's got a sticky clutch. Maybe your mechanic, you can figure out how to work it. It's nothing's perfect here. You're gonna need to figure it out.
Just go do your thing.
Yeah, it's a mechanic special. If you ever need to buy a used old car, like if you're buying like a truck to take to the dump or something,
that could happen.
And you'll see like, it's $1,500. You're like, why is it cheap? You'll always see whoever's on, it's a mechanic special. It's going to need some love.
Okay.
It's going to need someone to know how to fix these pieces. But all the core of it's there.
I'm trying to think of which would be less of, which I need less in my life. A truck to take stuff to the dump or a truck that doesn't work?
A truck to take to the dump, just to leave
exactly.
It there.
This truck is for the dump. What do you mean?
It doesn't
anymore. No, it just doesn't work. It needs to be put out to pasture. We need to relieve it of its duties at some point. All right. I saw this. I don't know that this interests you guys at all, but for those of you who are not in Justin's world of going to the dump every day.
Every day? Like I'm diving?
Dump diving. This jumped out to me this morning. These are five phrases to stop using during meetings. Does this intrigue you at all? It did for me. Here's five. This is from Harvard Business Review. It's from a woman named Ray Ringel, R-A-N-G-E-L. Number one, we're going to wait 5 minutes for everyone to join.
Mm.
She says that it's a little like, you're trying to establish punctuality, but it doesn't actually do anything for that. That instead you should use the time to try to learn about people or get them to focus a little bit more on their meeting. So, okay. I thought that was an interesting one. Two, you're on mute, which has become obviously the most common phrase in meetings in the last couple of years. She believes, and I don't know that you agree with this, that that's got a little bit of a negative connotation that makes the person who is on mute feel like they've done something wrong. I'm okay that because they have.
Yeah, call them out.
But she says, instead, try something like, if you're speaking, I can't hear you, which I feel like is just as insulting. In fact, maybe it depends on the tone of voice. If you're speaking, we can't hear you. Sounds like a lot worse than, hey, you're on mute. But whatever.
Yeah, you're on mute is fine.
That's what I think. All right. I don't know that I've heard this one ever, but we're building the plane while flying it. You ever heard anybody say that in a meeting?
Nope.
All right, me neither.
No.
Let's move
next.
On. The last two, definitely. Let's take this offline. Right? Like, oh, yeah, basically what you're saying is this conversation has deviated away from what we're supposed to be doing in this meeting. So we'll take this one offline. I don't know why that's necessarily a problem, but she wants a clear, quick mention of how and when this offline conversation will take place, because otherwise it's dismissive to the person who's walking down that path. Thoughts?
This feels like somebody's really worried about protecting feelings of people that are employees.
Welcome to management. All right. And then the final one is, I'm going to give you 10 minutes of your life back when you close a meeting 10 minutes early. And the thinking here is that you're essentially saying that your meetings are
wasting
worthless.
Their time.
Yeah. Normally my meetings are a waste of your time, but in this case, I'm going to give you 10 minutes of your life back. I think that's probably good. I like that one's the one I probably agree with the most.
I was expecting some kind of like circle back table this, that some of those comments.
Those are the other annoying ones.
I'm tired of hearing.
For sure, you don't want to circle back later on this one.
That's kind of what she was saying with the let's take this offline, I guess, too.
But I think her problem with take this offline is that it's it's derisive to the person who has been walking down the wrong road. So there you go. Just a little educational experience.
Don't do any of those on your Zoom meetings, Pete, is what you're saying.
Yes, exactly. And especially as you're meeting with Jody. Don't tell her, hey, Jody, I'm going to give you 10 minutes of your life back.
Hey, Jody, you're on mute.
I got to run. I got to run. Do you think if Jody's on mute, they just let her go? Like, well, I'm not going to tell her. Are you going to tell her? No. I'm not going to tell her. How about you? Mm-mm. All right, coming up next, we will tell you every single thing you need to know, including a look at all of the defensive coordinator candidates and another NFL executive with some thoughts on Russell Wilson's future. It's coming up. Don't go anywhere. Mike Salk Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
This is the Mike Salk Show.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio. Back in mornings from 6 to 10.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Well, reading Justin the list of meeting phrases, all I can think of is the dude's neighbor in Office Space. And he's like, anybody at your office ever tell you, your work ever tell you, I got a case of the Mondays?
Dietrich Bader.
So funny. This response is great. We'll hear from Bert Breer coming up in 15 minutes. I think you'll want to hear this. He has a really interesting outside take here on what's going on with the Seahawks and where they need to go next. We'll do that, as I said, coming up in 15 right after Need to Know.
Need to know.
15 minutes past every hour with Mike Salk.
Here's what you need to know. Up first.
Does Pete Carroll want to make changes or does Pete want to change voices? I think we're starting to get that answer. Some of the candidates to replace defense coordinator Ken Norton Jr. starting to leak out. Team made it official yesterday, relieving Norton of his duties along with defensive passing game coordinator Andre Curtis. It'd be difficult to complain, obviously, about the decision given the issues that the team has had with slow starts, defending the pass, getting off the field on third down, rushing the passer, causing turnovers, finding out the best way to use Jamal Adams. Man, when you say all this out loud, it's really a lot. Yikes. So back to our question. What exactly does Pete want to change? Much like the offensive coordinator hire last year, I think the names we've seen have a little bit of variation. Some are familiar with Pete, his scheme, his styles, etc. Others less so. So Clint Hurt is the current defensive line coach. He's known as a great communicator, great relationships with players, and is probably the most up-and-coming candidate at 43 years old, at least internally. Ed Donatell, 64 years old, has known Pete forever, though he's mostly coached 3-4 defenses. He's worked under folks like Jim Harbaugh and Vic Fangio. Then you got familiar names like Gus Bradley, who Pete inherited here in 2010. And then last night, Michael Sean DeGar added 38-year-old Chicago DC Sean Desai, who has an interesting background as a philosophy PhD, sees himself as a teacher. Mark Schlereth, certainly an advocate for Ed Donatell.
Ed's a great communicator. Ed has great relational skills with his players. You know, I think he fits from the philosophical competition aspect, won multiple Super Bowls as a coach.
That's Mark Schlereth from the local playground. I don't know if you can hear the background. It sounds like kids playing in the background.
He's in Hawaii.
Anyway, most of those names have a relationship with Pete. Two of them, though, come from other schematic trees, and they age in range from late 30s to mid-40s to mid-50s to mid-60s. None of them seem likely to make drastic changes necessarily to a scheme, yet at least a few of them seem likely to bring some new ideas based on their travel. So, I'll admit a little bias for Gus Bradley. I loved him when he was here. He's an incredible communicator. He knows Pete. He knows the system. He's not married to it. He's done other things. He had great success integrating Derwin James into the Chargers defense. And that's a player who at least has some similarities to Jamal Adams. I don't know if he's necessarily available because of the mess in Vegas, but I think he'd probably be my choice for those reasons. But I'm also intrigued by Desai because of his background, because of his youth. At the very least, his inclusion speaks to a process that's considering everyone, not just the obvious candidates who are familiar with the head coach or his scheme.
Here's the second thing you need to know.
Well, another day, more national speculation regarding the future of Russell Wilson. This time it was ESPN's Jeremy Fowler, who included Russ's future in a longer piece where he had league executives making predictions for the offseason. He's got an exec saying he thinks the team isn't as high on Russ as they say and that they could look to make a deal. Fowler speculates on New Orleans, Chicago, and the Giants as a few possibilities. All right, no, there's no rumors here. I'm not trying to spread them. These comments and stories I just think are interesting for a couple of reasons. First of all, they tell us what's out there. If an exec saying this, maybe he's trying to lower the market to acquire Russell Wilson. Or maybe he's trying to sow more discord. Or maybe the team's trying to get this out there themselves for whatever reason. And then secondly, I think it helps us consider how valuable we truly believe Russ to be. I think they're a better team with Russ than they are without him, and that'll be final. Like, that's just true. But if Russ isn't going to resign in the next couple of years and you don't believe you can realistically build a championship team before then, you got to seriously consider making a deal at that point. You have to do whatever gets you to a Super Bowl the fastest. There's no easy decision here, but that's got to be your guiding principle.
Here's the third thing you need to know.
Well, with the lockout still making major league transactions impossible, we did get some interesting tidbits yesterday out of the Mariners. They officially signed three international free agents using their entire pool of money on just three players. Those are infielders Michael Arroyo from Colombia, Martin Gonzalez from the Dominican Republic, and Cuban Lazaro Montez. Now, all three are 17 years old. Arroyo probably stands out as a really interesting hitter. He's got a ton of upside. I love the approach here from the Mariners. The farm system is where it is, one of the best in the business. So go big or go home. You can afford to gamble on fewer players with higher ceilings, and it sounds like what they've done. For what it's worth, also, Carlos Correa has decided to switch representation too. Scott Boras didn't offer a reason, but I'll take a guess. Maybe he wanted somebody as soulless and unlikable as him to be his agent, or maybe he just wanted to maximize his value. Actually, it's none of those things. He's taken a chance with an entertainment agency, William Morris, and now that agency has failed to build a baseball clientele and has been at cross purposes with the league for apparently attempting to purchase minor league franchises. Just a bizarre situation that only Carlos Correa would find himself in. Two games in the NBA last night. Minnesota over New York. Warriors get back on track. They crush Detroit. That is everything you need to know.
I thought you were going to say he was switching over to Mark Rogers.
No. No, he's not going to do that. He's going to go to Scott Boras.
When you said soulless and unlikable, I was like, I thought you were trying to build a bridge to that.
Scott Boras is a unique person, man. You got to give the guy credit for what he's built. Like, he's truly a genius in his field. I've never really seen anything like being, and I've spent some time at winter meetings. Been to, I don't know, four or five winter meetings. Used to pay for my own way to go and then just try to make enough money there while I was there to pay off the hotel room and the flights. And I love it. I love the winter meetings. To me, it's like the most exciting, cool thing you can do in this business. Just as a baseball dork, it's one of my favorites. But Boras will just, like, when he shows up to give his, like, state of the Scott Boras clients that week, he walks through. I'll never forget. This is at the Bellagio, and he's just walking through the hallways up to, like, where he's going to talk. And there's a crowd of like 35, 40, maybe 50 reporters all following him to get the quotes they need. And he ended up like standing on a chair, a table or something, like looking down at all of his minions.
Ugh.
And it was so hard to watch, man.
I love that.
It was really brutal.
Did you know that like Scott Boras and Pete Carroll are actually pretty close? When he did that Flying Coach podcast with Steve Kerr, they had him on and they were frat brothers in college.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
That's same age.
Scott Boras went to Pacific University? Interesting.
I believe so.
Wow.
I just pulled up the sound to double check. But.
They both, you know what they both do well? They both kind of like, they both have the look. They both wear the right clothes. I mean, for Pete, obviously, he's not getting dressed up as much. I mean, Boris's suits always look like, not that they look super fancy, but they always look super expensive. I always like, whenever I see him in person, I'm always like, I wonder if his sport jacket costs more than my entire wardrobe. And then Pete, just like anything Pete puts on, looks perfect on him. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's University of Pacific.
Who knew? All right, good information, Maura. I like that.
Interesting.
All right, coming up next, Albert Breer joined us. And I think if you're trying to figure out what happens next with the Seahawks, there's three or four tidbits in here that are of incredible importance. We'll hear from him, and then I'll try to break it down together next. Mike Salk Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to the Mike Salk Show,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio
on 710 ESPN Seattle.
We're just sitting back there, sorry, listening to more of this Scott Boras Pete Carroll podcast from last year. I didn't hear that.
Well,
I'm kind of fascinated.
They were
by
either,
this.
Yeah.
Who knew Pacific University was such a powerhouse for?
Yeah, it was that Flying Coach podcast with Steve Kerr on The Ringer. They had some interesting guests. If anyone wants to go back and listen to any of those, it was in the middle of COVID.
Yeah.
So I was looking for stuff for our sports show.
Everybody had time.
What was it called? The Flying what?
The Flying Coach, right?
Flying Coach.
Yeah, yeah, it was the Tim Kerr thing. I remember him, or Steve Kerr, sorry. You know, there was a hockey player named Tim Kerr in the 1980s who scored a bunch of goals for the Philadelphia Flyers for like a few years.
Still in your head.
And to this day, I struggle to call Steve Kerr by his name and not Tim Kerr, which is really embarrassing considering how small and random a footnote to sports history Tim Kerr was compared to how great Steve Kerr is. I mean, he's a really good player.
Just in your head,
and
yeah.
Now this, and I will never not screw. I still want to call him Tim Kerr, like 35, almost 40 years later.
And Tim Curry as well. It probably helps to connect those. In
Tim
your
Curry,
head.
Like the actor.
The actor.
Yes, he's in Clue, one of the all time great.
It's films. Also it.
That was like when the Seahawks drafted Gary Jennings. Yes. I kept wanting to call him Greg.
Well, because Greg was a good player.
Yeah.
And Gary was really, really bad. I could see how you'd make that issue. All right. Yesterday, we had an opportunity to catch up with Albert Breer from Sports Illustrated. He took over the Monday Morning Quarterback column for Peter King. And I think as you listen to this, I want to react to some of this afterwards, because the thoughts on where they're at with Russell Wilson, the thoughts on where they're at with Pete Carroll and kind of the future and how far away this franchise is, I think is awfully, awfully interesting and leads us down some pretty, pretty cool roads. It's Albert Breer, our friend from Sports Illustrated Monday Morning Quarterback. Good morning, Bert. How are we doing today?
Mike, what's happening?
Thanks for filling in for John. You got big shoes to fill. I know you will do it ably.
I know it.
Well, I mean, you filled in. I mean, you took over for Peter King, so obviously filling big shoes is not
so
like
that's why you called.
Yeah, exactly.
Because my experience cut. Yeah, that makes sense.
Hey, you did it better than me. I tried to fill in for Glenn Ordway. Look how that went. I mean, at least you're having some success with the whole thing. Let's talk about the Seahawks here.
We'll see. We'll see.
You go ahead.
No, I just say we'll see if we can make it work. Go ahead.
Better than me. Jeez. All right. Let's start with Russ. What do you see playing out? We know that Pete is going to be here. It sounds like John Schneider's obviously going to be here. They're going to make some changes, and I'll talk to you about the defense coordinator thing in a minute. But how do you see things playing out with Russell Wilson this offseason?
Well, you know, I think the owner would like to keep him. That's just my sense, having talked to people and not to her directly. You know, obviously what she does is awfully unpredictable just because she doesn't have any track record. And I think that went for the decisions on Pete and John too. Like, I think there were a lot of people that didn't know because there just isn't a track record there. I think the hedging from Russ's camp is not a great sign. Now we'll see if they can work something out, but you know, there's been an acknowledgement for a while that this could be the last contract he'll do with the team. He's got 2 years left in that contract. You know, and then, you know, you look at the state of things, where they were coming out of last year. And, you know, really Russ wanted three things. And he viewed this as sort of the turning the page to the second, you know, half of his career. Number one, he wanted a new offensive system, a new offensive scheme that he'd sign off on. He signed off on Shane Waldron. And that, like, you know, I think you can argue, you know, about how that's gone. He wanted a new piece for the offensive line. They went out and got Gabe Jackson. I think you'd argue they're in a worse spot on the offensive line now than they were a year ago because Dwayne Brown's up. And, you know, I don't know that there are great pieces for the future there. And then, you know, the third piece was he wanted a seat at the table and he wanted to be kind of a part of, you know, the decision-making process, the conversation there. And that's where the Seahawks drew the line. And so, like, I look at where he was last year and frustrated and wanting to go to a place where he can set himself up to make the Hall of Fame and make all pros and all that different stuff and compete for championships. And I don't know, Mike, it's hard for me to look at this and say, if he was upset and had all those demands after a 12-win year in which they won the division, where does he stand after a 6-win year? So I think there's still a lot they have to work out. And it wouldn't shock me at all if a couple of weeks from now, we're sitting here and, you know, he's sort of, you know, found a way to come to the same sort of agreement that the Lions came to with Matthew Stafford last year to trade him.
So what is his value? I mean, I was playing kind of the what if game. Daniel Jeremiah had a good tweet yesterday saying, who says no if the Eagles offer their three first round picks and next year second? Their picks are 15, 16, 19. Is that fair value? Is the Giants two picks at 5 and 7 fair value? I mean, how much is Russell worth?
Yeah, I mean, I think like the baseline that we've talked about with all of these quarterbacks is three first round picks. And, you know, like that was the baseline for Deshaun and the Texans had offers, you know, and before the draft, even more recently, that exceeded three first round picks. Now Deshaun's younger, so that's a factor, of course, and Deshaun's under contract for longer. I think Aaron Rodgers' market would go there too. So I think it would just be a matter of finding a team that really believes in Russell at that level and doesn't think that, you know, there's been any decay in his play over the last couple of years. And so to me, I think this comes down to the number of suitors you have. And I do think that, you know, you're looking in the right places. You know, the Giants have two first round picks, not just two first round picks, but two picks in the top 10. The Eagles, their three first round picks aren't as high, but they have three of them. That's all current year. So those are more valuable. So, you know, I think looking at those two teams is interesting. I think New Orleans would have an interest in them too. I think there are enough suitors out there. While there is some disagreement about where Russell stands right now as a player, I still think there are enough teams that like him at that level enough where the Seahawks would be able to go and get that three first-round pick price.
Talking to Albert Breer, filling in for John Clayton today. So Seahawks make a move last night. They let defensive coordinator Ken Norton Jr. go. I think that was, you know, pretty well expected around here given the way the defenses have started the last couple of years. We've heard a couple of early names, Clint Hurt, who's in the organization, and a couple of others. Ed Donatell's name is out there. If you're looking for a young, up-and-coming play, you know, X maybe, somebody who can relate to the young players and teach the system and learn from Pete, who really could bring some creativity to it, who's out there?
Oh, I mean, it's tough because, I mean, there are some names and some guys that just got promoted. You know, I would have given you Jonathan Gannon a year ago. And, you know, obviously, like, he's like a rocket ship now. He's Eagles defensive coordinator for a year, and he's a head coaching candidate. Same thing goes for D'Amico Ryans. Like, I think he would have been a great fit, you know, a couple of years ago if he had been available, you know, and he was a linebackers coach. And, yeah, I mean, I think that there's that question if you're Pete, do you want to project somebody into the role again? And promote from within again, or do you want to bring in somebody who's got a good level of experience? And so, I mean, Gus Bradley's, you know, availability is out there. I think the question with Gus would be, you know, has he evolved enough from what they were 8, 9, 10 years ago? And I would tell you this, like, I mean, you've seen where Dan Quinn is and what Dan Quinn's done in Dallas and now kind of reestablishing himself as a head coaching candidate. And obviously everybody in Seattle is really familiar with DQ. You know, one thing I would say about him and one reason why he's become such a hot candidate is because he's evolved everything that he was doing in Seattle. And they've moved past just being like the traditional cover three Pete Carroll defense, you know, both at the end in Atlanta and now in Dallas. Like they're much more diverse than DQ was when he was calling the defense in Seattle. And so, you know, I think it'd be interesting to look at a guy like Gus Bradley or somebody like that who has background in the defense. I think the question for Seattle is going to be, have you evolved enough? And to me, like, Dan Quinn's sort of the model for that, right? Like, has Gus Bradley done enough to evolve?
How does it work, and we only have a minute or two here, when you try to bring in somebody who's been in a completely different system and merge them, and the name Brock brought up earlier I thought was interesting was a Jerod Mayo, and I know he's doing some head coaching interviewing now, and if that doesn't work out, you know, up-and-comer, young guy, just recently stopped playing a few years ago, but comes more out of a Belichick system. How do fits like that tend to work?
I mean, I think we've seen it work in the past. I think the best example might be right there in the division, you know, with what Sean McVay did. And I know Sean McVay's not a defensive coach like Pete is, but you have to follow me here. You know, when Sean, you know, I think at the end with Wade Phillips, got a little frustrated, he started becoming way more involved on the defensive side of the ball. And to the point where, you know, he was, you know, partly responsible for building that Super Bowl game plan, the defensive game plan against the Patriots. And so, you know, what he did was he went back and said, who frustrates me the most? Who's the hardest coach for me to go up against? And it was Vic Fangio. And so he was like, all right, like, I got to find somebody who knows how to coach that defense. I want that defense here. And that's how he wound up with Brandon Staley. And then this year they brought in Raheem Morris, and Raheem Morris is from that Tampa 2 family. And, you know, basically they made Raheem Morris learn the Vic Fangio defense. It took some time, but now, I mean, you see what happened last night. It looks like it's clicked. So, you know, I think the key is the head coach has to have an idea of what he wants to do. And it's okay if you bring in somebody from the outside who has no new ideas. But I do think the head coach has to have that sort of concept of what he wants it to look like, because you can't have the head coach sitting here saying, well, I've always done it this way, and bring in a guy from the outside and say, just, you know, like, we're going to let you go. And then, you know, you get 4, 6, 8 games into the year and the thing's sort of a mishmash of two different systems. And so I think they have to be really, really clear about what they want from one of those guys. And Gerard Mayo, if he doesn't wind up getting a head coaching job, would make a lot of sense because I think he would bring some new ideas. But I don't know that he's as just kind of stuck in doing things one way because he's only been coaching for 3 years. I think he'd be open to doing things a little different way, and it would probably help him too evolve as a coach. The problem with somebody like that, of course, would be the potential that you could lose him in a year or two because he is a hot head coach in Canada.
Well, and then things may be very different here in a couple of years anyway. So, yeah, good stuff. Bert,
right.
You filled
so
maybe,
in. Maybe it doesn't matter.
You filled in ably. I think the Professor's fans out there will be impressed. So thank you very much. Good to catch up with you, man. We'll talk soon.
All right, thanks, Mike. I appreciate it.
All right, there's Albert Breer from SI and from Monday Morning Quarterback. Does a great job, and he's an old friend of mine, so I love having him on the show and just his perspective on this. He filled in yesterday for John Clayton. Now, since, I'll just say this quickly, and then I want to address some of the things we heard from Bert. Since we talked yesterday, there's been one more candidate added, obviously, here to the defensive coordinator hiring list, and that is Sean Desai, who is right now the defense coordinator in Chicago. They fired their head coach, so he's sort of in that limbo, kind of like Gus Bradley, where you're like, well, he's still technically employed there. They don't have to grant an interview, but they're going to hire a head coach who may or may not want him. So we'll see what happens with a couple of guys like that. But I was texting some friends who are in the Chicago sports media business, and I can read you some of what they said about Desai. A lot of it, I think, is very positive. But one of the things that has me a little worried, in fact, makes me wonder if there's actually room for him here in Seattle, is that they all call him the Professor. And I would say that has been specifically taken here in Seattle. There is no room for a second Professor.
Well, I mean, would Clayton allow it because Desai is an actual, he is a professor?
Maybe,
right?
If he was from Pittsburgh, I think John would probably, if he was from Braddock, PA, when we could ask John in 2 hours at 8:45, if he was a Braddock guy, yeah, but he's a Connecticut guy, went to Boston University and all that. I don't know if there's going to be room for him and John Clayton here in this town.
Only so
this,
one.
This may destroy the idea. Do you want to hear what they did say beyond that? About him. I think it's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Very well liked, respected by the players. They do call him the Professor because of his background and how smart he is. He's a Vic Fangio guy, which is interesting. That's a couple of Vic Fangio guys. So Pete kind of delving into a system that maybe has given him some fits in the past. Showed some creative stuff that led to the rushers coming free. Don't know if they'll grant the interview, etc. Yeah, that's pretty accurate. He's got degrees. He climbed his way to this point very impressively. He's got a new school mind, but that didn't manifest on the field as much as people thought it might. But some occasional exotic blitzes, did a great job with terrible talent in the secondary, and shut down Jefferson from Minnesota in week 15, and that was like a big moment. So there are just a couple of thoughts on Sean Desai.
Yeah, I guess that is the wonders if the Bears would grant permission, because that was like one of the bright spots in their season.
Absolutely.
Their defense did start playing a lot better. But someone they had in-house that they promoted.
But if you're going to bring in a new coach, does that person want to bring in all their own people? Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you don't need to hold on. I mean, Gus Bradley was here when Pete got here, ended up becoming the defensive coordinator under Pete, and it turned out to be a really great marriage for a couple of years before Gus eventually moved on to become a head coach. So, yeah, we'll see. So I still love Gus Bradley. I can't help it. He's just such a I missed him. I loved him when he was here. I really enjoyed talking to him. One of my favorites.
You bring up that he was nicknamed the Professor. I raise you this in Sean Desai's Twitter bio, which, by the way, he has never tweeted.
Okay.
Not a single thing.
But he's got a bio.
It very well could not be him, but I think it is. At the end of his bio, well, first I'll read you the whole thing. Husband, father, educator, football coach with the Bears. Keeping it real since 83. Last line, I prefer not to sleep.
Well, he sounds perfect.
Fits right in.
Maybe Russ has a role in the defensive
coordinator. Well, I asked that this morning. I'm like, do you think Russ thinks he should have a hand in picking the defensive coordinator as well?
Only 809 followers. Maybe it's not quite
well. Real. Make you 810. Jump right on there, and you can let us know if he does tweet, hey, I'm on my way to Seattle.
Turn the alerts on.
Yeah, then we'll know a little bit more. Let me play this from Albert Breer. So this was from the interview we just had, but this small 10-second moment really jumped out to me. And Bert said this before, but when he said it again yesterday, kind of reminded me of it and kind of got me thinking, in a slightly different way about the whole Russ thing.
I think the hedging from Russ's camp is not a great sign. Now, we'll see if they can work something out, but, there's been an acknowledgement for a while that this could be the last contract he'll do with the team.
It's that last part. There's been an acknowledgement for a while that this is probably the last contract he'll do with the team. I've heard him say that before. It's been a while. He said that a few months ago, maybe even a year ago. But I remember him saying it. It's just now kind of coming back into this cloudy brain of mine. And that part's really interesting. That is what makes it, it changes the way I view the entirety of who wants to do what this offseason. Because I think the prevailing opinion is if Russell Wilson wants to be dealt and makes it obvious to the Seahawks that he wants out right now, do they listen, right? Do they oblige? That's been kind of the general narrative that when we think about Russell Wilson, that's where it is. It's that the Seahawks would only be reacting to Russell saying, I want out of here. Okay, well, let's see what we've got. The quote there from Breer, and I'm not saying that this is gospel, but I know Burt and I trust him. If that's true, does it affect the way you view it? It's almost more like when some of the teams in baseball try to deal somebody before they know they're going to lose them, right? They used to do it 3 months away from the end of that person's last season, right, at the trade deadline, and try to get whatever they could for them. But now they know they need to do it almost a year or two earlier than that in order to truly maximize value because other GMs got smart and didn't want a three-month rental and give up the farm for them. So, you know, the days of Jeff Bagwell getting dealt for Larry Anderson, those days have largely gone away because if you want a Jeff Bagwell, you want to deal for him not for the last 3 months, or if you want a Larry Anderson, rather, you want to deal not for the last few months, but you want to deal from get some actual value out of that trade, right? You want to get a year or two. So that's why you see some of the big names in baseball move a year or two before their contract is up. Well, in football, deals get done. I mean, contracts get done a year before the contract is up, right? That's when extensions happen. They don't come down to the wire if you can avoid it. So if you are going to try to maximize value for Russell Wilson, it's kind of now or never, right? Now, it's not saying that they may very well choose never, and this report may be something that they can overcome, and maybe they think they can work out a new deal and kind of continue on, or maybe they want to go down the franchise tag route. I don't know. But if you are the Seahawks and you truly believe that Russell Wilson is not going to sign another contract with you in 2 years, do you deal him now? If you think it's impossible, I'm not saying it is impossible. If it was, you knew impossible, he will not steadfastly for all the money in the world, he will not sign a deal with you. Would you deal him now? Or would you try to win a Super Bowl in the next 2 years before he leaves? You think you're close enough to win a Super Bowl in the next 2 years?
I think we're light years further away from the opposite of that. By dealing him and trying to replacing it and then getting the Super Bowl, that path has gone now from 2 to 5 to 10 years versus
10?
Being close.
How did you just get to 10?
Because I'm a Bengals fan.
Well, that's taking a very negative view of that.
The text we got yesterday of the value you get for what you could bring in for him still is not up to what you have by him staying for these next 2 years. So no, I would keep him for the next 2 years and get as much as I could out.
But if he's going to leave anyway, just playing devil's advocate here, they have a history of waiting too long and getting nothing for guys.
Sure. You got nothing for Richard Sherman. You got nothing for Earl Thomas. You got, right, like some of these guys eventually.
Michael Bennett.
Right. Like I mean, they all just ended up being done, flipping you off on the way out the door in one case. And that's not going to happen with Russ. To me, this becomes almost a crucial question, and you have to believe Albert's report in order to move forward with this line of thinking. I don't know whether that's true. I don't know whether Russell Wilson would consider signing another deal here. Maybe he would, and this is just a philosophical conversation inspired by the fact that Sean Desai is a philosophy major at BU and a Temple, right? Maybe this is nothing more than a hypothetical. But that's a report. I mean, that's a legitimate reporter who I have some level of trust in who has heard that they believe Russ won't sign another deal. So if he won't, Justin, I would disagree with you. If you think that you can win in the next 2 years, fine. You should load up for bear right now and try to win this thing in a hurry. That means spending every dime you have in the next 2 years going for broke, and if that ends in a couple of years and Russ leaves, so be it. And maybe the Hail Mary of trying to win the Super Bowl in the next couple of years, maybe it's enough to keep Russ long term and he changes his mind and you're able, you know, everything is fickle and in flux. Yeah.
But and if, and but that if, would prove to him, hopefully, that we, maybe he would want another deal. So
maybe it would. But if you can't do that, you're going to run the risk that you're pushing back that Super Bowl timeline even farther. Because I could write you a script where you say, all right, here's the plan to get to the Super Bowl the soonest. That's my goal. Get to the Super Bowl as soon as possible. You trade Russ now. You bring back as much value as you possibly can. And you start rebuilding. You kind of do what the Mariners just did, right? You do what you did in 2010.
Yeah.
You let Matt Hasselbeck go. You had two first-round picks because of a deal you'd made the year before you got here. And you started building the whole thing and brought up a ton of young talent with high picks, right? And you hit on a couple of guys in the mid-rounds, and you turn the whole thing over. And that was your quickest path for a Super Bowl. By the way, it didn't take that long. It took 4 years. It wasn't 10. It took, I mean, and really, I guess, yeah, 4 years, 2010, 11, 12, and then in 13, you're in the Super Bowl. 12, you were really good.
Okay, then I'm also thinking about how long do I have Pete?
Well, and maybe, yeah, maybe that's a big part of this equation as well, right? Maybe Pete and Russ want to try to give this a go over the next 2 years and say, hey, we each have 2 years together. What do we need to do? And if that's the case, then that needs to affect how you handle this offseason. That's why the Russ conversation is interesting. Not because I'm trying to push some narrative that you need to deal Russell Wilson. But because the thought exercise leads you down the path of what you're not going to trade Russell Wilson. Great. You're better off, for sure. You're not going to replace Russell Wilson with anybody better in the next couple of years. I believe that as well as you do. But if that's the case, then all right, what are you going to do in 2 years to get great?
You need to go all in.
All in. You can't take the view. You're not trading back. You can't take this view of, well, we got to give ourselves as many bites at the apple as we can over the next few years. You've got to change your philosophy and be all in on being all in.
Be more like the Rams. Find money. All of a sudden, they're signing guys that you're like, how do they still have money?
Go sacrifice
your
future.
You don't have the draft picks.
Exactly right. Sacrifice your future for the now. Right?
Yes.
I mean, and go all out. That means you got to go get Chandler Jones and Akeem Hicks and this and that and this and that and try to power yourselves into position, and the future be damned, because the future is likely going to be without Russell Wilson. So if that's the direction you want to go, then do it. And if you want to go the other direction, then trade the man and figure out the best path to get to a Super Bowl in 4 or 5 years, because that's your best path forward. But the in-between, it doesn't do it for me. Never has, never will. I'm not an in-between guy. I want to go all in on one direction or the other, and I think the Seahawks right now need to make that choice. So if I keep talking about Russell Wilson trades and I keep playing this cut from Albert Breer over the course of the next few months, don't get mad at me. It's not about trying. I mean, you can. That's part of the fun. But like, it's not that I'm trying to drive home a narrative to get anybody out of town. It's just that important exercise helps you make all of the other decisions that need to get made to get to the point that we all want, which is for the Seahawks to be back in the Super Bowl and winning another championship.
You're an all-in guy, says the guy who cuts up all the donuts into small pieces.
Well, I'm not all in on that. I'm all in on eating as many different types of donuts as you can. That's just being a pig, which is why I'm back on the diet and trying to shed these pounds. It's Mike Salk Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.